You're recording.
Right.
Have fun.
Okay. Is there a hold button?
I think if you hit pause, it'll. But don't hold.
No, I mean hold, so I don't knock keys. Yeah, yes, yeah, there is. All right. So now we're just. But then I won't be able to ride the fade up a bit. But.
But maybe keep it on, and if you want
to. Yeah, I'll just. Okay. So.
Great.
Good. Can I put a marker on, like to say, oh, like.
Oh, something good happened there?
No, no. Or so when we start hearing music. Or
it's okay. You probably can, but I haven't read that far in the manual.
Yeah, all right.
Okay. I'm sure you can, but yeah. Okay. It's beyond me.
And it, so if I'll just hold this on. Yeah. Okay.
Everybody gather right. Hello.
You really are.
Thanks very much for coming down. My name's Barry Esch and I work for a company called Arica. We put on events like this, maybe Install in Glasgow that you might know as well. This event is part of a tour called Shadowed Spaces, which is kind of a touring project sponsored by the Scottish Arts Council and their Tune Up Fund, which takes places musical performances in parts of our towns and cities which have a certain kind of elusive ambience to them. Places that are overlooked, maybe unconsidered, places that maybe once formerly had a use and now don't, and places where sometimes you can feel a sense of privacy in public, or where you can go to do things that you might not want to share with everybody, which I think in some ways is analogous to musical performance. To get started tonight, the event takes about 75 minutes, an hour tops, other way around, an hour, 75 minutes tops. We're not going to be traipsing through Easter House, we're just going to be walking around this little area here. To start with, thanks very much for Jackie from Platform for helping us sell all the tickets and getting everybody to come along. I think she's here somewhere. I don't know if she isn't. Thank you, Jackie. To get started, we've got a map theoretician and psychogeographer who's going to talk a little bit about the kind of principles of psychogeography. If you're interested in hearing about any of that, then please come with me into this little hollow over here. Thank you again, and have a good time.
Good evening. My name is Dennis Wood, and I'm a psychogeographer. It's not a name I've used to describe myself for quite a while, but it certainly is one I come by quite legitimately and used to use as a matter of course. As it turns out, I've been talking about different things as we've been moving from, we started in Aberdeen, and we went to Dundee, and yesterday we did something under the off-ramp from the M8 in Glasgow. And each time I've been talking about something a little different. And tonight I thought I'd like to say a few words about psychogeography. As a word, it was coined in any of its current senses in the early 1950s by Guy Debord, who at the time was a member of the Letterist International. The Letterists were a manifestation or face of the avant-garde in France following World War II and the gradual dissolution of surrealism. And some of what they were doing grew out of their dissatisfaction with surrealism, rather explicitly. Debord was really interested at this point in the relationship between the environment and human behavior. And he was particularly interested in the effect the environment had on people. And he was interested in that in a very complicated kind of way. He really hated what was happening to Paris. He hated the ongoing efforts at urban reconstruction that were, he felt, destroying the parts of Paris that he really loved. And he wanted to be able to talk about those parts of Paris in a way that was, in his view, objective in some meaningful sense of that word. And what he was looking for in these places was an aspect that he described as a unity of ambience, and that he was careful to think about in terms of desire and passion. But he also seemed to imply that these spaces had the power to liberate something that was important and human in us, and that therefore it would be an immense loss to Paris if these places were lost. In order to study these, he created a method, which he called the drift, the dérive. And drifting has, much to, I'm sure, a lot of people's surprise, become kind of popular in the last 10 or 15 years. But as constructed by Debord, it was a very specific kind of activity. What he was going to do was use human beings to locate these places with this kind of important unity of ambience, this powerful urban character that he felt was so important. And he was going to do that by asking them to move through the city, but having freed themselves of all agendas. One thing you had to do to go on a drift was not have any purpose at all. You couldn't have any intention. Because if you did, the subtle power of the city to act on you wouldn't be able to act in characteristic force or in full force. And so, first of all, you had to have no purpose at all. You had to, like, clear the day. And in fact, it was best, he discovered, if you cleared a whole bunch of days and drifted for several days on end. It's really hard to recover exactly the conditions under which they drifted, but there was a lot of alcohol involved and maybe some other things as well. You also had to drift in groups. You could not drift alone. Technically, he acknowledges you can drift alone, but he was anxious that if you did drift alone, you might allow your own subjectivity to somehow interact with the urban environment, and hence the city wouldn't be acting on you itself. So you wanted to go in groups, small groups, but groups, 3, 5, 6, these were numbers that he thought were particularly useful, particularly valuable. And what would happen here is that you would sort of invalidate each other's subjectivities, and so the resultant drift as you move through the environment would be an objective measure of the city's attractiveness as it pulled you here or pulled you there, or pulled you one place or another. He made maps of Paris based on these drifts, two of them famously in 56 and 57. The second with Asger Jorn. Discourse of the Passions of Love was the first one. The second one was A Naked City. Maybe many of you have seen them. They're powerfully evocative collages of small elements of the city, the unities of ambience, connected by arrows, which represented the forces of the city acting on you. And you're supposed to be able to follow these maps. You take the map, you release yourself, you follow the map. You will be drawn down the red arrow from one unity of ambience to another. There are switching stations as well you can be drawn into, out of which you can move in more than one direction to different unities of ambience. All this is forgotten very rapidly. The situationists into which the Letterist International evolved played an extremely important role in the events of May 1968. And in the early 70s, the Situationist movement was dissolved. And that was that. A forgotten, soon forgotten moment of excitement in very, very, there were never many Situationists. There were handfuls of them. And they were lost. right. Yeah, let me stop that story there for a second, because at the same time that he's doing that, another entirely independent activity is taking place in Cambridge, Massachusetts. An urban planner at MIT named Kevin Lynch is also extremely distressed about the urban planning that's taking place and that is destroying, as he saw it, the parts of the cities that he loved and that he thought were important. He's an urban planner, he's been academically trained, he's teaching, in fact, at this time, and it becomes important to him to understand how it is that people move around and feel about the city. And he carries out a surprising number of activities, some of which are absolutely parallel to what Du Bord is doing. He wants to know what ordinary people see when they walk around the city, and he walks around the city with ordinary people, and he records them talking. He asks them questions and gets them talking, and then he records it. And then he tries to analyze these results. In the late 50s, he entered into a project with Gregory Kepisch, which led to the publication of his book, The Image of the City. And in this work, he did a systematic analysis of the images of Los Angeles, Jersey City, and Boston. And he did this by having people, among other things, draw sketch maps of their city. And these sketch maps would become an important part of what would rapidly become known in eastern Massachusetts, in any event, as psychogeography. He wrote The Image of the City, published it in 1960, and it's filled with these maps that are produced by, in each one of these three cities, one of these maps is produced by somebody literally walking around. The title is The Image of Boston as Seen Through Field Observations. And it's nothing at all like Guy Debord's maps. But, in fact, it's very similar in character, and it has, in fact, as it turned out, a very similar erratic power. People looked at these maps, and they began to have the feeling you were just, like, literally slicing people's heads open, and you could look inside and see what they thought the city was. And it powerfully attracted a young psychologist named David Stay, who would end up being appointed to a geography position at Clark University. Clark University is in Worcester, Massachusetts, and it had a very powerful geography department, famous geography department, and psychology department. It's the only institution in the United States, for example, that Sigmund Freud ever lectured at. So it had these two strong psychology and geography traditions, and they thought they'd bring them together, and they made this joint appointment of a psychologist on a geography faculty. And he began teaching a course, which, of course, the students very, very rapidly called, it was originally called Environment Behavior 201 or something, and it very soon was called by everybody Psychogeography. And the second year that Stay taught the course, it in fact was officially labeled psychogeography. And although I didn't do it, my ex-wife actually took a master's written exam in psychogeography. Maybe the only master's exam that's ever been offered and taken in psychogeography. Which, given the perspective at this point in time, is really a kind of hilarious idea. Psychogeography had a brief but powerful run at Clark. It produced a lot of really, really interesting work by people like myself. I entered Clark as a geography student, and I wrote my master's thesis under David Stay, examining the image of San Cristobal de las Casas in the state of Chiapas in Mexico in the minds of the teenagers, 300 of them. I was able to get to draw sketch maps and do other things for me. And then for my doctoral dissertation, again in geography, but under the supervision of the psychologist Robert J. Beck, I brought 36 teenagers to Europe who had never been here before, and as they lived in London and then Rome and then Paris, I had them draw me maps on a continuing basis in an effort to understand the microgenesis of their image of these cities, since in fact it turns out to be really hard to do a longitudinal study of people's developing images of these cities. A number of us went on, well, most of us who did this kind of work went on to work in applied areas or into psychology. And in fact, psychogeography rapidly mutates in American academies into something called today environmental psychology. And there are environmental psychologies that were established by or continued by or grown by students trained in psychogeography at Clark University in the late 60s and early 70s. As happened with the situation of psychogeography, geographic psychogeography dies as well. It fades into a kind of quiescent backwater where nobody knows much about it. Nobody It's a vague memory in some people's heads. It's kept alive, interestingly enough, in planning departments staffed by students of Kevin Lynch, so that you can go to strange cities in the United States and elsewhere, in fact, and find that the planners there have carried out Lynch-like studies of the images of the cities held in the minds of their inhabitants. Minneapolis and Jerusalem and Albuquerque, a really strange and diverse number of these cities. These were collected in through the 80s, as a matter of fact, but I don't know of any that were collected after the 80s. So as we come into like the early 90s, psychogeography, I think it'd be really, really hard to find it used in any discourse by anybody in, let's say, 1988. Guy Debord's book, The Society of the Spectacle, begins to become notorious and important in theorizing a whole range of Marxist, particularly Marxist problems. And the book becomes translated to English translations, it's translated into other languages, and as Debord becomes popular, his writing is increasingly translated. And the fugitive writings in which he embedded his psychogeography begin to be diffused. And the idea of psychogeography, the idea of the drift in particular, become powerful. And people start drifting. They start drifting, and they start calling themselves psychogeographers. At the same time, there's an interest that's been developing, and maybe some of the roots go back to some of these activities, in history, in feminist history, in queer history, in labor history, in uncovering these buried histories that shed light on the realities of the spaces that we live in that are hard to see through what would be regarded as the myth of the normative structure of the stories that are told about where these places came from and how they evolved. These things come together in psychogeography in the early 90s, and they grow together to a point today where there are regular assemblies of psychogeographers. I don't know if the ProvFlux is still going on right now, but Providence, Rhode Island, for example, it's ProvFlux. If it's not going on, it just ended. Is an annual gathering of psychogeographers in Providence. The New York City Conflux takes place every fall, and psychogeographers come to the Conflux from all over the world to participate in a whole range of activities that really sort of make me sigh as a psychogeographer, because they have a kind of looseness and flexibility. I don't want to claim any proprietorial, you know, territory, but they have a kind of laxness that led one psychogeographer, Kanna Rinka, last year to title her talk, "Has Psychogeography Become Nothing More Than Entertainment for Middle-Class Kids?" And there's a danger of that it just dissolves into a kind of, let's go out and drift through the city and you know, hey, I have no objection to that. I think that's a great thing, and I think everybody should do it, and I think they should do it all the time. But, okay, you can call it whatever you want. I really don't care. But I think these two histories of psychogeography have a potential importance in both characterizing what the field could be and suggesting directions in which it could develop, perhaps a little more fruitfully than just becoming a name for what I sort of feel it is in, like, Ian Sinclair. It really sort of means a combination of what I would have thought about as historical geography and really keen observation. And, of course, those are both extremely valuable things, and if you want to bring them together and call them something, I think maybe calling them psychogeography is terrific. But there's more to the potential that psychogeography opened up than merely a keen observation, which is extremely wonderful thing to have, and trying to uncover buried histories, which is, you know, I have to say, also extremely valuable. The one thing that really links the two psychogeographies together is that both of the traditions used human beings to try and measure the environment, to try and understand the environment. They didn't take air photos and measure, they didn't clock, they didn't count. They sent human beings out into the environment, and through the performance of these people, tried to get some understanding of what the environment was. Debord trying to uncover this terrain of passion as he saw it. Lynch really interested in a terrain of knowledge, how people knew things. but in both cases, sending people out and allowing them to be the instrument that measured how the environment was. Actually, what's turned out to be very interesting to me is that on this tour, we have three really subtle instruments. Our three musicians, there was a point at which Sean Meehan, one of the drummers, said, you know, it doesn't really matter where we go. We sort of play the same thing, but I've heard them play now three times in the last 5 days, and the sites have produced extraordinarily different responses. So it seems to me they're really, really subtle ways of trying to come to grips with the kinds of environments we've asked them to perform in. So without further ado, I think we should sort of wander up to that green space up there where Sean is going to respond to that particular environment. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you.
very much for coming along. I think these guys are going to give us a song now. Hey. Come on, Ali, I want to hear it.
Get all your cameras in here. Bring it on.
Yeah, we just got back. I thought it was going to be the only thing. We just got back. We're around Europe.
I'm not singing that, man. That's
Thank you.